I could have let you get your nose punched on this. Once would have been enough for you. What do you mean? You'll tell them, because there's a hard streak in you. There's something in you that's like biting on tin foil. Whatever it takes to make success, you've got it. You'll have a nice little career, middle-of-the-road pop no one will remember in 5 years. The junior high boppers will collect your records. You'll make money. Larry balled his fists on his legs. He wanted to punch that calm face. Wayne was saying things that made him feel like a small pile of dog shit beside a stop sign. "Go back and pull the plug," Wayne said softly. "Then you get in that car and go. Just go, man. Stay away until you know that next royalty check is waiting for you." "But Dewey—" "I'll find a man to talk to Dewey. My pleasure, man. The guy will tell Dewey to wait for his money like a good little boy, and Dewey will be happy to oblige." He paused, watching two small children in bright bathing suits run up the beach. A dog ran beside them, ralphing loudly and cheerily at the blue sky. Larry stood up and forced himself to say thanks. The sea breeze slipped in and out of his aging shorts. The word came out of his mouth like a brick. "You just go away somewhere and get your shit together," Wayne said, standing up beside him, still watching the children. "You got a lot of shit to get together. What kind of manager you want? What kind of tour you want? What kind of contract you want after Pocket Savior hits? I think it will. It's got that neat little beat. If you give yourself some room, you'll figure it all out. Guys like you always do." "Guys like you always do. Guys like me always do. Guys like..." Somebody was tapping a finger on the window. Larry jerked, then sat up. A bolt of pain went through his neck, and he winced at the dead, cramped feel of the flesh there. He had been asleep, not just dozing, reliving California. But here and now it was gray New York daylight, and the finger tapped again. He turned his head, cautiously and painfully, and saw his mother, wearing a black net scarf over her hair, peering in. For a moment they just stared at each other through the glass, and Larry felt curiously naked, like an animal being looked at in the zoo. Then his mouth took over, smiling, and he cranked the window down. "Mom?" "I knew it was you," she said in a queerly flat tone. "Come on out of there and let me see what you look like standing up." Both legs had gone to sleep. Pins and needles tingled up from the balls of his feet as he opened the door and got out. He had never expected to meet her this way, unprepared and exposed. He felt like a sentry who had fallen asleep at his post suddenly called to attention. He had somehow expected his mother to look smaller, less sure of herself, a trick of the years that had matured him and left her just the same. But it was almost uncanny the way she had caught him. When he was 10, she used to wake him up on Saturday mornings after she thought he had slept long enough by tapping one finger on his closed bedroom door. She had wakened him this way 14 years later, sleeping in his new car like a tired kid who had tried to stay up all night and got caught by the Sandman in an undignified position. Now he stood before her, his hair corkscrewed, a faint and rather foolish grin on his face. Pins and needles still coursed up his legs, making him shift from foot to foot. He remembered that she always asked him if he had to go to the bathroom when he did that, and now he stopped the movement and let the needles prick him at will. "Hi, Mom," he said. She looked at him without saying anything, and a dread suddenly roosted in his heart like an evil bird coming back to an old nest. It was a fear that she might turn away from him, deny him, show him the back of her cheap coat, and simply go off to the subway around the corner, leaving him. Then she sighed, the way a man will sigh before picking up a heavy bundle. And when she spoke, her voice was so natural and so mildly, rightly pleased that he forgot his first impression. "Hi, Larry," she said. "Come on upstairs. I knew it was you when I looked out the window. I already called in sick at my building. I got sick time coming." She turned to lead him back up the steps, between the vanished stone dogs. He came 3 steps behind her, catching up, wincing at the pins and needles. "Mom?" She turned back to him, and he hugged her. For a moment, an expression of fright crossed her features, as if she expected to be mugged rather than hugged. Then it passed, and she accepted his embrace and gave back her own. The smell of her sachet slipped up his nose, evoking unexpected nostalgia, fierce, sweet, and bitter. For a moment he thought he was going to cry, and was smugly sure that she would. It was a touching moment. Over her sloped right shoulder he could see the dead cat, lying half in and half out of the garbage can. When she pulled away, her eyes were dry. "Come on, I'll make you some breakfast. Have you been driving all night?" "Yes," he said, his voice slightly hoarse with emotion. "Well, come on. Elevator's broken, but it's only two floors. It's worse for Mrs. Halsey with her arthritis. She's on 5. Don't forget to wipe your feet. If you track in, Mr. Freeman will be on me like a shot. I swear Goshen he can smell dirt. Dirt's his enemy, all right." They were on the stairs now. "Can you eat 3 eggs? I'll make toast, too, if you don't mind pumpernickel. Come on." He followed her past the vanished stone dogs and looked a little wildly at where they had been, just to reassure himself that they were really gone, that he had not shrunk 2 feet, that the whole decade of the 1980s had not vanished back into time. She pushed the doors open and they went in. Even the dark brown shadows and the smells of cooking were the same. Alice Underwood fixed him 3 eggs, bacon, toast, juice, coffee. When he had finished all but the coffee, he lit a cigarette and pushed back from the table. She flashed the cigarette a disapproving look, but said nothing. That restored some of his confidence. Some, but not much. She had always been good at biding her time. She dropped the iron spider skillet into the gray dishwater, and it hissed a little. She hadn't changed much, Larry was thinking. A little older, she would be 51 now, a little grayer, but there was still plenty of black left in that sensibly netted head of hair. She was wearing a plain gray dress, probably the one she worked in. Her bosom was still the same large comber blooming out of the bodice of the dress. A little larger, if anything. "Mom, tell me the truth, has your bosom gotten bigger? Is that the fundamental change?" He started to tap cigarette ashes into his coffee saucer. She jerked it away and replaced it with the ashtray she always kept in the cupboard. The saucer had been sloppy with coffee, and it had seemed okay to tap in it. The ashtray was clean, reproachfully spotless, and he tapped into it with a slight pang. She could bide her time, and she could keep springing small traps on you until your ankles were all bloody and you were ready to start gibbering. "So you came back," Alice said, taking a used Brillo from a table talk pie dish and putting it to work on the skillet. "What brought you?" "Well, Ma, this friend of mine clued me into the facts of life. The assholes travel in packs, and this time they were after me. I don't know if friend is the right word for him. He respects me musically about as much as I respect the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. But he got me to put on my traveling shoes, and wasn't it Robert Frost who said home is a place that when you go there they have to take you in?" Aloud, he said, "I guess I got to missing you, Mom." She snorted. "That's why you wrote me often?" "I'm not much of a letter writer." He pumped his cigarette slowly up and down. Smoke rings formed from the tip and drifted off. "You can say that again." Smiling, he said, "I'm not much of a letter writer." "But you're still smart to your mother. That hasn't changed." "I'm sorry," he said. "How have you been, Mom?" She put the skillet in the drainer, pulled the sink stopper, and wiped the lace of soap suds from her reddened hands. "Not so bad," she said, coming over to the table and sitting down. "My back pains me some, but I got my pills. I make out all right." "You haven't thrown it out of whack since I left." "Oh, once, but Dr. Holmes took care of it." "Mom, those chiropractors are..." "Just frauds." He bit his tongue. "Are what?" He shrugged uncomfortably in the face of her hooked smile. "You're free white and 21. If he helps you, fine." She sighed and took a roll of wintergreen lifesavers from her dress pocket. "I'm a lot more than 21, and I feel it. Want one?" He shook his head at the lifesaver she had thumbed up. She popped it into her own mouth instead. "You're just a girl yet," he said with a touch of his old bantering flattery. She had always liked it, but now it brought only a ghost of a smile to her lips. Any new men in your life? Several, she said. How about you? No, he said seriously. No new men. Some girls, but no new men. He had hoped for laughter, but got only the ghost smile again. I'm troubling her, he thought. That's what it is. She doesn't know what I want here. She hasn't been waiting for 3 years for me to show up after all. She only wanted me to stay lost. Same old Larry, she said. Never serious. You're not engaged? Seeing anyone steadily? I play the field, Mom. You always did. At least you never came home to tell me you'd got some nice Catholic girl in a family way. I'll give you that. You were either very careful, very lucky, or very polite. He strove to keep a poker face. It was the first time in his life that she had ever mentioned sex to him, directly or obliquely. Anyway, you're going to learn, Alice said. They say bachelors have all the fun. Not so. You just get old and full of sand. Nasty, the way that Mr. Freeman is. He's got that sidewalk-level apartment, and he's always standing there in the window hoping for a strong breeze. Larry grunted. I hear that song you got on the radio. I tell people that's my son, that's Larry. Most of them don't believe it. You've heard it? He wondered why she hadn't mentioned that first, instead of going into all this piddling shit. Sure, all the time on that rock and roll station the young girls listen to. WROK. Do you like it? As well as I like any of that music. She looked at him firmly. I think some of it sounds suggestive. Lewd. He found himself shuffling his feet and forced himself to stop. It's just supposed to sound passionate, Mom, that's all. His face suffused with blood. He had never expected to be sitting in his mother's kitchen discussing passion. The place for passion's the bedroom, she said curtly, closing off any aesthetic discussion of his hit record. Also, you did something to your voice. You sound like a nigger. Now? He asked, amused. No, on the radio. That Brown sound, she sure do get around, Larry said, deepening his voice to Bill Withers' level and smiling. Just like that, she nodded. When I was a girl, we thought Frank Sinatra was daring. Now they have this rap. Rap, they call it. Screaming, I call it. She looked at him grudgingly. At least there's no screaming on your record. I get a royalty, he said. A certain percent of every record sold. It breaks down to, oh, go on, she said, and made a shooing gesture with her hand. I flunked all my maths. Have they paid you yet, or did you get that little car on credit? They haven't paid me much, he said, skating up to the edge of the lie, but not quite over it. I made a down payment on the car. I'm financing the rest. Easy credit terms, she said balefully. That's how your father ended up bankrupt. The doctor said he died of a heart attack, but it wasn't that. It was a broken heart. Your dad went to his grave on easy credit terms. This was an old rap, and Larry just let it flow over him, nodding at the right places. His father had owned a haberdashery. A Robert Hall had opened not far away, and a year later his business had failed. He had turned to food for solace, putting on 110 pounds in 3 years. He had dropped dead in the corner luncheonette when Larry was 9, a half-finished meatball sandwich on his plate in front of him. At the wake, when her sister tried to comfort a woman who looked absolutely without need of comfort, Alice Underwood said it could have been worse. It could, she said, looking past her sister's shoulder and directly at her brother-in-law, have been drink. Alice brought Larry the rest of the way up on her own, dominating his life with her proverbs and prejudices until he left home. Her last remark to him as he and Rudy Schwartz drove off in Rudy's old Ford was that they had poor houses in California, too. Yes, sir, that's my mama. Do you want to stay here, Larry? She asked softly. Startled, he countered, Do you mind? There's room. The rollaway's still in the back bedroom. I've been storing things back there, but you could move some of the boxes around. All right, he said slowly. If you're sure you don't mind. I'm only in for a couple of weeks. I thought I'd look up some of the old guys. Mark, Galen, David, Chris, those guys. She got up, went to the window, and tugged it up. You're welcome to stay as long as you like, Larry. I'm not so good at expressing myself, maybe, but I'm glad to see you. We didn't say goodbye very well. There were harsh words. She showed him her face, still harsh, but also full of a terrible, reluctant love. For my part, I regret them. I only said them because I love you. I never knew how to say that just right, so I said it in other ways. That's all right, he said, looking down at the table. The flush was back. He could feel it. Listen, I'll chip in for stuff. You can if you want. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I'm working. Thousands aren't. You're still my son. He thought of the stiffening cat, half in and half out of the trash can, and of Dewey the deck, smilingly filling the hospitality bowls, and he suddenly burst into tears. As his hands blurred double in the wash of them, he thought that this should be her bit, not his. Nothing had gone the way he thought it would, nothing. She had changed after all. So had he, but not as he had suspected. An unnatural reversal had occurred. She had gotten bigger, and he had somehow gotten smaller. He had not come home to her because he had to go somewhere. He had come home because he was afraid, and he wanted his mother. She stood by the open window, watching him. The white curtains fluttered in on the damp breeze, obscuring her face, not hiding it entirely, but making it seem ghostly. Traffic sounds came in through the window. She took the handkerchief from the bodice of her dress and walked over to the table and put it in one of his groping hands. There was something hard in Larry. She could have taxed him with it, but to what end? His father had been a softy, and in her heart of hearts she knew it was that which had really sent him to the grave. Max Underwood had been done in more by lending credit than taking it. So when it came to that hard streak, who did Larry have to thank or blame? His tears couldn't change that stony outcropping in his character any more than a single summer cloudburst can change the shape of a rock. There were good uses for such hardness. She knew that, had known it as a woman raising a boy on her own in a city that cared little for mothers and less for their children. But Larry hadn't found any yet. He was just what she had said he was, the same old Larry. He would go along, not thinking, getting people, including himself, into jams, and when the jams got bad enough, he would call upon that hard streak to extricate himself. As for the others, he would leave them to sink or swim on their own. Rock was tough, and there was toughness in his character, but he still used it destructively. She could see it in his eyes, read it in every line of his posture, even in the way he bobbed his cancer stick to make those little rings in the air. He had never sharpened that hard piece of him into a blade to cut people with, and that was something. But when he needed it, he was still calling on it as a child did, as a bludgeon to beat his way out of traps he had dug for himself. Once, she had told herself Larry would change. She had. He would. But this was no boy in front of her. This was a grown-up man. And she feared that his days of change, the deep fundamental sort her minister called a change of soul rather than one of heart, were behind him. There was something in Larry that gave you the bitter zing of hearing chalk screech on a blackboard. Deep inside, looking out, was only Larry. He was the only one allowed inside his heart. But she loved him. She also thought there was good in Larry, great good. It was there, but this late on it would take nothing short of a catastrophe to bring it out. There was no catastrophe here, only her weeping son. "You're tired," she said. "Clean up. I'll move the boxes, then you can sleep. I guess I'll go in today after all." She went down the short hall to the back room, his old bedroom, and Larry heard her grunting and moving boxes. He wiped his eyes slowly. The sound of traffic came in the window. He tried to remember the last time he had cried in front of his mother. He thought of the dead cat. She was right. He was tired. He had never been so tired. He went to bed and slept for nearly 18 hours. Chapter 6 It was late afternoon when Franny went out back to where her father was patiently weeding the peas and beans. She had been a late child, and he was in his 60s now, his white hair coming out from under the baseball cap he always wore. Her mother was in Portland, shopping for white gloves. Fran's best childhood friend, Amy Lauder was getting married early next month. She looked down at her dad's back for a peaceful moment, just loving him. At this time of day, the light took on a special quality that she loved, a timeless quality that belonged only to that most fleeting main genus, early summer. She could think of that particular tone of light in the middle of January, and it would make her heart ache fiercely. The light of an early summer afternoon as it slipped toward dark had so many good things wrapped up in it. Baseball at the Little League Park, where Fred had always played third and batted cleanup. Watermelon, first corn, iced tea and chilled glasses. Childhood. Franny cleared her throat a little.
Need a hand?
He turned and grinned.
Hello, Fran. Caught me digging, didn't you?
I guess I did. Is your mother back yet? He frowned vaguely, then his face cleared.
No, that's right, she just went, didn't she?
Sure, pitch a hand if you want to. Just don't forget to wash up afterward.
A lady's hands proclaim her habits, Fran mocked lightly and snorted.
Peter tried to look disapproving and did a poor job of it. She got down in the row next to him and began to weed. Sparrows were twittering and there was a constant hum of traffic on US-1, less than a block from here. It hadn't reached the volume it would in July, when there would be a fatal accident nearly every day between here and Kittery, but it was building. Peter told her about his day, and she responded with the right questions, nodding in places. Intent on his work, he wouldn't see her nods, but the corner of his eye would catch her shadow nodding. He was a machinist in a large Sanford auto parts firm, the largest auto firm north of Boston. He was 64 and about to start on his last year of work before retirement. A short year at that, because he had 4 weeks' vacation time stockpiled, which he planned to take in September, after the idiots went home. The retirement was much on his mind. He was trying not to look at it as a never-ending vacation, he told her. He had enough friends in retirement now who had brought back the news that it wasn't like that at all. He didn't think he would be as bored as Harlan Ender's or as shamefully poor as the Karens. There was poor Paul, hardly ever missed a day at the shop in his life, and yet he and his wife had been forced to sell their house and move in with their daughter and her husband. Peter Goldsmith hadn't been content with Social Security. He had never trusted it, even in the days before the system began to break down under recession, inflation, and the steadily increasing number of people on the books. There hadn't been many Democrats in Maine during the 30s and 40s, he told his listening daughter. But her grandfather had been one, and her grandfather had, by God, made one out of her father. In a Gunkwit's palmiest days, that had made the Goldsmiths pariahs of a kind. But his father had had one saying as rock-ribbed as the stoniest Maine Republican's philosophy. Put not your trust in the princes of this world, for they will frig thee up and so shout their governments, even unto the end of the earth. Franny laughed. She loved it when her dad talked this way. It wasn't a way he talked often, because the woman that was his wife and her mother would, and had, all but cut the tongue out of his head with the acid which could flow so quickly and freely from her own. You had to trust yourself, he continued, and let the princes of this world get along as best they could with the people who had elected them. Most times that wasn't very well, but that was okay. They deserved each other. Hard cash is the answer, he told Franny. Will Rogers said it was land because that's the only thing they're not making any more of, but the same goes for gold and silver. A man who loves money is a bastard, someone to be hated. A man who can't take care of it is a fool. You don't hate him, but you got to pity him. Fran wondered if he was thinking of poor Paul Karen, who had been his friend since before Fran herself was born, and decided not to ask. At any rate, she didn't need him to tell her that he had socked away enough in the good years to keep them rolling. What he did tell her was that she had never been a burden to them, in good times or in bad, and he was proud to tell his friends he had sent her through school. What his money and her brains hadn't been able to take care of, he told them, she had done the old-fashioned way, by bending her back and shucking her buns. Working, and working hard, if he wanted to cut through the country bullshit. Her mother didn't always understand that. Changes had come for women, whether the women always liked them or not, and it was hard for Carla to get it through her head that Fran wasn't down there at UNH husband hunting. She sees Amy Lauder get married, Peter said.
and she thinks that should be my Fran. Amy's pretty, but when you put my Fran beside her, Amy Lauder looks like an old dish with a crack in it. Your mother has been using the old yardsticks all her life, and she can't change now. So if you and her scrape together a bit and make some sparks from time to time, like steel against flint, that's why. No one is to blame. But you have to remember, Fran, she's too old to change. But you are getting old enough to understand that.
From this, he rambled back to his job again, telling her about how one of his co-workers had almost lost his thumb in a small press because his mind was down at the pool hall while his damn thumb was under the stamp. Good thing Lester Crowley had pulled him away in time. But, he added, someday Lester Crowley wouldn't be there. He sighed, as if remembering he wouldn't be either, then brightened and began telling her about an idea he'd had for a car antenna concealed in the hood ornament. His voice switched from topic to topic, mellow and soothing. Their shadows grew longer, moving up the rows before them. She was lulled by it, as she always had been. She had come here to tell something, but since earliest childhood she had often come to tell and stayed to listen. He didn't bore her. So far as she knew, he didn't bore anyone, except possibly her mother. He was a storyteller and a good one. She became aware that he had stopped talking. He was sitting on a rock at the end of his row, tamping his pipe and looking at her. "What's on your mind, Franny?" She looked at him dumbly for a moment, not sure how she should proceed. She had come out here to tell him, and now she wasn't sure if she could. The silence hung between them, growing larger, and at last it was a gulf she couldn't stand. She jumped. "I'm pregnant," she said simply. He stopped filling his pipe and just looked at her. "Pregnant," he said, as if he had never heard the word before. Then he said, "Oh, Franny, is it a joke or a game?"
"No, Daddy."
"You better come over here and sit with me." Obediently, she came up the row and sat next to him. There was a rock wall that divided their land from the town common next door. Beyond the rock wall was a tangled, sweet-smelling hedge that had long ago run wild in the most amiable way. Her heart was pounding, and she felt a little sick to her stomach.
"For sure?" he asked her.
"For sure," she said. And then, there was no artifice in it, not a trace. She simply couldn't help it.
She began to cry in great braying sobs. He held her with one arm for what seemed to be a very long time. When her tears began to taper off, she forced herself to ask the question that troubled her the most.
"Daddy, do you still like me?"
"What?"
He looked at her, puzzled.
"Yes, I still like you fine, Franny."
That made her cry again, but this time he let her tend herself while he got his pipe going. Borkum Riff began to ride slowly off on the faint breeze.
"Are you disappointed?" she asked.
"I don't know. I never had a pregnant daughter before, and am not sure just how I should take it."
"Was it that Jess?" She nodded.
"You told him?"
She nodded again. "What did he say?"
"He said he would marry me, or pay for an abortion."
"Marriage or abortion?" Peter Goldsmith said and drew on his pipe. "He's a regular two-gun Sam."
She looked down at her hands, splayed on her jeans. There was dirt in the small creases of the knuckles and dirt under the nails. "A lady's hands proclaim her habits," the mental mother spoke up. "A pregnant daughter. I'll have to resign my membership in the church. A lady's hands..." Her father said,
"I don't want to get any more personal than I have to, but wasn't he, or you, being careful?"
"I had birth control pills," she said. "They didn't work."
"Then I can't put any blame unless it's on both of you," he said, looking at her closely.
"And I can't do that, Franny. I can't lay blame.
64 has a way of forgetting what 21 was like, so we won't talk about blame."
She felt a great relief come over her, and it was a little like swooning. "Your mother will have plenty to say about blame," he said, "and I won't stop her, but I won't be with her. Do you understand that?" She nodded. Her father never tried to oppose her mother anymore, not out loud.
There was that acid tongue of hers. When she was opposed, it sometimes got out of control, he had told Franny once. And when it was out of control, she just might take a notion to cut anyone with it and think of sorry too late to do the wounded much good. Franny had an idea that her father might have faced a choice many years ago. Continued opposition resulting in divorce or surrender. He had chosen the latter, but on his own terms. She asked quietly, "Are you sure you can stay out of this one, Daddy?" "You asking me to take your part?" "I don't know." "What are you going to do about it?" "With Mom?" "No, with you, Franny." "I don't know." "Marry him? Two can live as cheap as one, that's what they say, anyway." "I don't think I can do that. I think I've fallen out of love with him, if I was ever in." "The baby?" His pipe was drawing well now, and the smoke was sweet on the summer air. Shadows were gathering in the garden's hollows, and the crickets were beginning to hum. "No, the baby isn't the reason why. It was happening anyway. Jesse is..." She trailed off, trying to put her finger on what was wrong with Jesse, the thing that could be overlooked by the rush the baby was putting on her, the rush to decide and get out from under the threatening shadow of her mother, who was now at a shopping mall buying gloves for the wedding of Fran's childhood friend. The thing that could be buried now but would nonetheless rest unquiet for 6 months, 16 months, or 26, only to rise finally from its grave and attack them both. "Marry in haste, repent in leisure," one of her mother's favorite sayings. "He's weak," she said. "I can't explain it better than that." "You don't really trust him to do right by you, do you, Franny?" "No," she said, thinking that her father had just gotten closer to the root of it than she had. She didn't trust Jesse, who came from money and wore blue chambray work shirts. "Jesse means well. He wants to do the right thing, he really does, but we went to a poetry reading 2 semesters ago. It was given by a man named Ted Enslin. The place was packed. Everyone was listening very solemnly, very carefully, so as not to miss a word. And me, you know me." He put a comfortable arm around her and said, "Franny got the giggles." "Yeah, that's right. I guess you know me pretty well." "I know a little," he said. The giggles, I mean, just came out of nowhere. I kept thinking, the scruffy man, we all came to listen to the scruffy man. It had a beat like a song you might hear on the radio. And I got the giggles. I didn't mean to. It really didn't have anything to do with Mr. Enslin's poetry. It was pretty good, or even with the way he looked. It was the way they were looking at him." She glanced at her father to see how he was taking this. He simply nodded for her to go on. "Anyway, I had to get out of there. I mean, I really had to. And Jesse was furious with me. I'm sure he had a right to be mad. It was a childish thing to do, a childish way to feel, I'm sure. But that's the way I often am. Not always. I can get a job done." "Yes, you can." "But sometimes..." "Sometimes King Laugh knocks, and you're one of those people who can't keep him out," Peter said. "I guess I must be. Anyway, Jess isn't one of those people. And if we were married, he'd keep coming home to that unwanted guest that I had let in. Not every day, but often enough to make him mad. Then I'd try and I guess..." "I guess you'd be unhappy," Peter said, hugging her tighter against his side. "I guess I would," she said. "Don't let your mother change your mind, then." She closed her eyes, her relief even greater this time. He had understood, by some miracle. "What do you think of me getting an abortion?" she asked after a while.
"My guess is that's really what you wanted to talk about."
She looked at him, startled. He looked back, half quizzical, half smiling, one bushy eyebrow, the left, cocked. Yet the overall impression she took from him was one of great gravity.
"Maybe that's true," she said slowly.
"Listen," he said, and then fell paradoxically silent. But she was listening, and she heard a sparrow, crickets, the far high hum of a plane, someone calling for Jackie to come on in now, a power mower, a car with a glass-pack muffler accelerating down US-1. She was just about to ask him if he was all right when he took her hand and spoke. "Franny, you've no business having such an old man for a father, but I can't help it. I never married until 1956. He looked at her thoughtfully in the dusk light. Carla was different in those days. She was, oh, hellfire, she was young herself, for one thing. She didn't change until your brother Freddie died. Until then, she was young. She stopped growing after Freddie died. That, you mustn't think I'm talking against your mother, Franny, even if it sounds a little like I am. But it seems to me that Carla stopped growing after Freddie died. She slapped 3 coats of lacquer and 1 of quick-dry cement on her way of looking at things and called it good. Now she's like a god in a museum, and if she sees anyone tampering with the ideas on display there, she gives them a lot of look out below. But she wasn't always like that. You'll just have to take my word for it, but she wasn't. What was she like, Daddy? Why, he looked vaguely out across the garden. She was a lot like you, Franny. She got the giggles. We used to go down to Boston to see the Red Sox play, and during the 7th-inning stretch, she'd go out with me to the concession and have a beer. Mama drank beer? Yes, she did. And she'd spend most of the 9th in the ladies and come out cussing me for making her miss the best part of the game, when all the time it was she telling me to go down to the concession stand and get 'em. Franny tried to imagine her mother with a cup of Narragansett beer in one hand, looking up at her father and laughing, like a girl on a date. She simply couldn't do it. She never kindled, he said, bemused. We went to a doctor, she and I, to see which of us was wrong. The doctor said neither one. Then in 60, there came your brother Fred. She just about loved that boy to death, Fran. Fred was her father's name, you know. She had a miscarriage in 65, and we both figured that was the end of it. Then you came along in 69, a month early, but just fine. And I just about loved you to death. We each had one of our own, but she lost hers. He fell silent, brooding. Fred Goldsmith had died in 1973. He'd been 13, Franny 4. The man who hit Fred had been drunk. He had a long list of traffic violations, including speeding, driving so as to endanger, and driving under the influence. Fred had lived 7 days. "I think abortion's too clean a name for it," Peter Goldsmith said. His lips moved slowly over each word as if they pained him. "I think it's infanticide, pure and simple. I'm sorry to say so, to be so inflexible, Seth, whatever it is I'm being, about something which you now have to consider, if only because the law says you may consider it. I told you I was an old man." "You're not old, Daddy," she murmured. I am," he said roughly. He looked suddenly distraught. "I'm an old man trying to give a young daughter advice, and it's like a monkey trying to teach table manners to a bear. A drunk driver took my son's life 17 years ago, and my wife has never been the same since. I've always seen the question of abortion in terms of Fred. I seem to be helpless to see it any other way, just as helpless as you were to stop your giggles when they came on you at that poetry reading, Franny. Your mother would argue against it for all the standard reasons. Morality, she'd say. A morality that goes back 2,000 years. The right to life. All our Western morality is based on that idea. I've read the philosophers. I range up and down them like a housewife with a dividend check in the Sears and Roebuck store. Your mother sticks with the Reader's Digest, but it's me that ends up arguing from feeling, and her from the codes of morality. I just see Fred. He was destroyed inside. There was no chance for him. These right-to-life biddies hold up their pictures of babies drowned in salt and arms and legs scraped out onto a steel table. So what? The end of a life is never pretty. I just see Fred lying in that bed for 7 days, everything that was ruined pasted over with bandages. Life is cheap. Abortion makes it cheaper.
I read more than she does, but she is the one who ends up making more sense on this one. What we do and what we think, those things are so often based on arbitrary judgments when they are right. I can't get over that. It's like a block in my throat. How all true logic seems to proceed from irrationality, from faith. I'm not making much sense, am I?
I don't want an abortion, she said quietly, for my own reasons.
What are they?
The baby is partly me, she said, lifting her chin slightly. If that's ego, I don't care.
Will you give it up, Franny?
I don't know.
Do you want to?
No, I want to keep it.
He was silent. She thought she felt his disapproval.
You're thinking of school, aren't you? She asked.
Nope, he said, standing up. He put his hands in the small of his back and grimaced pleasurably as his spine crackled. I was thinking we've talked enough, and that you don't have to make that decision just yet.
Mom's home, she said.
He turned to follow her gaze as the station wagon turned into the drive, the chrome winking in the day's last light. Carla saw them, beeped the horn, and waved cheerily.
I have to tell her, Franny said.
Yes, but give it a day or two, Franny.
All right.
She helped him pick up the gardening tools, and then they walked up toward the station wagon together. Chapter 7 In the dim light that comes over the land just after sunset but before true dark, during one of those very few minutes that movie makers call the magic hour, Vic Palfrey rose out of green delirium to brief lucidity. I'm dying, he thought, and the words clanged strangely through his mind, making him believe he had spoken aloud, although he had not. He gazed around himself and saw a hospital bed, now cranked up to keep his lungs from drowning in themselves. He had been tightly secured with brass laundry pins, and the sides of the bed were up. Been thrashing some, I guess, he thought with faint amusement. Been kicking up Dickens. And belatedly, where am I? There was a bib around his neck, and the bib was covered with clots of phlegm. His head ached. Queer thoughts danced in and out of his mind, and he knew he had been delirious, and would be again. He was sick, and this was not a cure or the beginning of one, but only a brief respite. He put the inside of his right wrist against his forehead and pulled it away with a wince, the way you pull your hand off a hot stove. Burning up all right and full of tubes. Two small clear plastic ones coming out of his nose. Another one snaked out from under the hospital sheet to a bottle on the floor, and he surely knew where the other end of that one was connected. Two bottles hung suspended from a rack beside the bed, a tube coming from each one and then joining to make a Y that ended by going into his arm just below the elbow. An IV feed. You'd think that would be enough, he thought, but there were wires on him as well, attached to his scalp, and chest, and left arm. One seemed to be plastered into his son-of-a-bitchin' belly button. And to cap it all off, he was pretty sure something was jammed up his ass. What in God's name could that one be? Shit radar?
Hey!
He had intended a resonant, indignant shout. What he produced was the humble whisper of a very sick man. It came out surrounded on all sides by the phlegm on which he seemed to be choking. Mama, did George put the horse in? That was the delirium talking, an irrational thought, zooming boldly across the field of more rational cogitation like a meteor. All the same, it almost fooled him for a second. He wasn't going to be up for long. The thought filled him with panic. Looking at the scrawny sticks of his arms, he guessed he had lost as much as 30 pounds, and there hadn't been all that much of him to start with. This whatever it was going to kill him. The idea that he might die babbling insanities and inanities like a senile old man terrified him.
Georgie's gone courting Norma Willis. You get that horse yourself, Vic, and put his nose bag on like a good boy.
Ain't my job.
Victor, you love your mama now?
I do, but it ain't. You got to love your mama now. Mama's got the flu.
No, you don't, Mama. You got TB. It's the TB that's going to kill you. In 1947. And George is going to die just about 6 days after he gets to Korea. Time enough for just one letter, and then bang, bang, bang. George is, Vic, you help me now and put that horse in, and that is my last word on it.
I'm the one with the flu, not her,
he whispered, surfacing again.
It's me.
He was looking at the door and thinking it was a damn funny door even for a hospital. It was round at the corners, outlined with pop rivets, and the lower jamb was set 6 inches or more up from the tile floor. Even a jackleg carpenter like Vic Palfrey could give me the funnies.
Vic, you had 'em long enough. Mama, he took my funny pages. Give 'em back. Give 'em back.
Build better than that. It was steel. Something in the thought drove a nail deep into his brain, and Vic struggled to sit up so he could see the door better. Yes, it was. It definitely was. A steel door. Why was he in a hospital behind a steel door? What had happened? Was he really dying? Had he best be thinking of just how he was going to meet his God? God, what had happened? He tried desperately to pierce the hanging gray fog, but only voices came through, far away, voices he could put no names against. Now what I say is this. They just got to say, fuck this inflation shit. Better turn off your pumps, Hap.
Hap? Bill Hapscombe? Who was he? I know that name.
Holy moly.
They're dead, okay?
Give me your hand and I'll pull you up out of there.
Give me the funnies, Vic. You had...
At that moment, the sun sank far enough below the horizon to cause a light-activated circuit, or in this case an absence of light-activated circuit, to kick in. The lights went on in Vic's room. As the room lit up, he saw the row of faces observing him solemnly from behind two layers of glass, and he screamed, at first thinking these were the people who had been holding conversations in his mind. One of the figures, a man in doctor's whites, was gesturing urgently to someone outside Vic's field of vision, but Vic was already over his scare. He was too weak to stay scared long, but the sudden fright that had come with the silent bloom of light in this vision of staring faces, like a jury of ghosts in their hospital whites, had cleared away some of the blockage in his mind, and he knew where he was. Atlanta. Atlanta, Georgia. They had come and taken him away, him and Hap and Norm's wife, and Norm's kids. They had taken Hank Carmichael, Stu Redman. God alone knew how many others. Vic had been scared and indignant. Sure, he had the snuffles and sneezes, but he surely wasn't coming down with cholera or whatever it was that poor man Campion and his family had had. He'd been running a low-grade fever, too, and he remembered that Norm Bruett had stumbled and needed help getting up the steps to the plane. His wife had been scared, crying, and little Bobby Bruett had been crying, too. Crying and coughing. A raspy, croupy cough. The plane had been at the small landing strip outside of Braintree, but to get beyond the Arnett town limits they had had to pass a roadblock on U.S. 93, and men had been stringing barbed wire. Stringing barbed wire right out into the desert. A red light flashed on over the strange door. There was a hissing sound, then a sound like a pump running. When it kicked off, the door opened. The man who came in was dressed in a huge white pressure suit with a transparent faceplate. Behind the faceplate, the man's head bobbed like a balloon enclosed in a capsule. There were pressure tanks on his back, and when he spoke, his voice was metallic and clipped, devoid of all human quality. It might have been a voice coming from one of those video games, like the one that said, "Try again, Space Cadet," when you fucked up your last go. It rasped, "How are you feeling, Mr. Palfrey?" But Vic couldn't answer. Vic had gone back down into the green depths. It was his mama he saw behind the faceplate of the white suit. Mama had been dressed in white when Papa took him and George to see her for the last time in the sanitarium. She had to go to the sanitarium so everybody else in the family wouldn't catch what she had. TB was catching. You could die. He talked to his mama. Said he would be good and put in the horse. Told her George had taken the funnies. asked her if she felt better, asked her if she thought she would be home soon. And the man in the white suit gave him a shot, and he sank deeper, and his words became incoherent. The man in the white suit glanced back at the faces behind the glass wall and shook his head. He clicked an intercom switch inside his helmet with his chin and said, "If this one doesn't work, we'll lose him by midnight." For Vic Palfrey, magic hour was over. "Just roll up your sleeve, Mr. Redman," the pretty nurse with the dark hair said. "This won't take a minute." She was holding the blood pressure cuff in two gloved hands. Behind the plastic mask, she was smiling as if they shared an amusing secret. "No," Stu said. The smile faltered a little. "It's only your blood pressure. It won't take a minute." "No." "Doctor's orders," she said, becoming businesslike. "Please." "If it's doctor's orders, let me talk to the doctor."
"I'm afraid he's busy right now. If you'll just—"
"I'll wait," Stu said equably, making no move to unbutton the cuff of his shirt sleeve.
"This is only my job. You don't want me to get in trouble, do you?"
This time she gave him a charming waif smile.
"If you'll only let me—"
"I won't," Stu said. "Go back and tell them. They'll send somebody." Looking troubled, the nurse went across to the steel door and turned a square key in a lock plate. The pump kicked on, the door shushed open, and she stepped through. As it closed, she gave Stu a final, reproachful look. Stu gazed back blandly. When the door was closed, he got up and went restlessly to the window, double-paned glass and barred on the outside. But it was full dark now, and there was nothing to see. He went back and sat down. He was wearing faded jeans and a checked shirt, and his brown boots with the stitching beginning to bulge up the sides. He ran a hand up the side of his face and winced disapprovingly at the prickle. They wouldn't let him shave, and he haired up fast. He had no objection to the tests themselves. What he objected to was being kept in the dark, kept scared. He wasn't sick, at least not yet, but scared plenty. There was some sort of snow job going on here, and he wasn't going to be a party to it anymore until somebody told him something about what had happened in Arnett and what that fellow Campion had to do with it. At least then he could base his fears on something solid. They had expected him to ask before now. He could read it in their eyes. They had certain ways of keeping things from you in hospitals. 4 years ago, his wife had died of cancer at the age of 27. It had started in her womb and then just raced up through her like wildfire, and Stu had observed the way they got around her questions, either by changing the subject or giving her information in large technical lumps. So he simply hadn't asked, and he could see it had worried them. Now it was time to ask, and he would get some answers, in words of one syllable. He could fill in some of the blank spots on his own. Campion and his wife and child had something pretty bad. It hit you like the flu or a summer cold, only it kept on getting worse, presumably until you choked to death on your own snot or until the fever burned you down. It was highly contagious. They had come and got him on the afternoon of the 17th, 2 days ago. 4 army men and a doctor, polite but firm. There was no question of declining. All 4 of the army men had been wearing sidearms. That was when Stu Redman started being seriously scared. There had been a regular caravan going out of Arnett and over to the airstrip in Braintree. Stu had been riding with Vic Palfrey, Hap, the Bruettes, Hank Carmichael and his wife, and 2 Army non-coms. They were all crammed into an Army station wagon, and the Army guys wouldn't say aye, nay, or maybe, no matter how hysterical Lila Bruette got. The other wagons were crammed, too. Stu hadn't seen all the people in them, but he had seen all 5 of the Hodges family, and Chris Ortega, brother of Carlos, the volunteer ambulance driver. Chris was the bartender down at the Indian Head. He had seen Parker Nason and his wife, the elderly people from the trailer park near Stu's house. Stu guessed that they had netted up everyone who had been in the gas station and everyone that the people from the gas station said they'd talked to since Campion crashed into the pumps. At the town limits there had been 2 olive-green trucks blocking the road. Stu guessed the other roads going into Arnett were most likely blocked off, too. They were stringing barbed wire, and when they had the town fenced off, they would probably post sentries. So it was serious. Deadly serious.
He sat patiently in the chair by the hospital bed he hadn't had to use, waiting for the nurse to bring someone. The first someone would most likely be no one. Maybe by morning they would finally send in a someone who would have enough authority to tell him the things he needed to know. He could wait. Patience had always been Stuart Redmond's strong suit. For something to do, he began to tick over the conditions of the people who had ridden to the airstrip with him. Norm had been the only obvious sick one, coughing, bringing up phlegm, feverish. The rest seemed to be suffering to a greater or lesser degree from the common cold. Luke Bruett was sneezing. Lila Bruett and Vic Palfrey had mild coughs. Hap had the sniffles and kept blowing his nose. They hadn't sounded much different from the first and second grade classes Stu remembered attending as a little boy, when at least two-thirds of the kids present seemed to have some kind of a bug. But the thing that scared him most of all, and maybe it was only coincidence, was what had happened just as they were turning onto the airstrip. The army driver had let out three sudden bellowing sneezes. Probably just a coincidence. June was a bad time in East Central Texas for people with allergies. Or maybe the driver was just coming down with a common garden variety cold instead of the weird shit the rest of them had. Stu wanted to believe that, because something that could jump from one person to another that quickly. Their army escort had boarded the plane with them. They rode stolidly, refusing to answer any questions except as to their destination. They were going to Atlanta. They would be told more there, a bald-faced lie. Beyond that, the army men refused to say. Hap had been sitting next to Stu on the flight, and he was pretty well sloshed. The plane was army, too, strictly functional, but the booze and the food had been first-class airline stuff. Of course, instead of being served by a pretty stewardess, a plank-faced sergeant took your order, but if you could overlook that, you could get along pretty well. Even Lila Bruett had calmed down with a couple of grasshoppers in her. Hap leaned close, bathing Stu in a warm mist of scotch fumes.
"This is a pretty funny bunch of old boys, Stuart. Ain't one of 'em under 50, nor one with a wedding ring. Career boys, low rank."
About half an hour before they touched down, Norm Bruett had some kind of a fainting spell, and Lila began to scream. Two of the hard-faced stewards bundled Norm into a blanket and brought him around in fairly short order. Lila, no longer calm, continued to scream. After a while, she threw up her grasshoppers and the chicken salad sandwich she had eaten. Two of the good old boys went expressionlessly about the job of cleaning it up.
"What is all this?" Lila screamed. "What's wrong with my man? Are we going to die? Are my babies going to die?"
She had one baby in a headlock under each arm, their heads digging into her plentiful breasts. Luke and Bobby looked frightened and uncomfortable and rather embarrassed at the fuss she was making.
"Why won't somebody answer me? Isn't this America?"
"Can't somebody shut her up?" Chris Ortega had grumbled from the back of the plane. "Christly woman's worse than a jukebox with a broken record inside it." One of the army men had forced a glass of milk on her, and Lila did shut up. She spent the rest of the ride looking out the window at the countryside, passing far below and humming. Stu guessed there had been more than milk in that glass. When they touched down, there had been four Cadillac limousines waiting for them. The Arnett folks got into three of them. Their army escort had gotten into the fourth. Stu guessed that those good old boys with no wedding rings, or close relatives, probably, were now somewhere right in this building. The red light went on over his door. When the compressor or pump or whatever it was had stopped, a man in one of the white spacesuits stepped through. Dr. Denninger. He was young. He had black hair, olive skin, sharp features, and a mealy mouth.
"Patty Greer says you gave her some trouble," Denninger's chest speaker said as he clopped over to Stu.
"She's quite upset." "No need for her to be," Stu said easily. It was hard to sound easy, but he felt it was important to hide his fear from this man. Denninger looked and acted like the kind of man who would ride his help and bully-rag them around, but lick up to his superiors like an egg-sucked dog. That kind of man could be pushed a ways if he thought you held the whip hand, but if he smelled fear on you, he would hand you the same old cake, a thin icing of "I'm sorry, I can't tell you more" on top,
and a lot of contempt for stupid civilians who wanted to know more than what was good for them underneath.